night, good evening, everybody. This is Terry Koop, host of the Blue Plate Special, and tonight I am more than pleased to be serving up Gabino Iglesias. He is the writer of Zero Saints, which has been called an instant wild-ass classic, which should launch its author far from outlier status into the wet, palpitating heart of contemporary literature. When he's not in the middle of the palpitating heart of contemporary literature, he works as a freelance journalist and has convinced a college to give him a PhD. His nonfiction has been everywhere from the New York Times to several Spanish language publications, and his fiction has been everywhere from Down in the Gutter to out into Divergent magazine. He also claims that when he's not fighting ninja squirrels, he devours books and spits out reviews. And we'll be talking more about his book reviews later. Gabino, good to see you, bro. How you doing?
Thank you. Great to finally meet you, and thank you for having me.
Oh, it's fantastic. The one thing about the Blue Plate Special is I decided to make it multi-genre. We're going to be having a little bit of everybody on here. And that leads me right into the first thing. You call your genre barrio noir. What's that about?
I started writing horror, and then I wrote a lot of straight crime fiction, and we all have this process where we're looking for our voice, what we want to do, what we want to define our fiction as being. And my first novella was Bizarro, and Bizarro is probably one of my favorite genres to work in because there are no rules. You can do whatever you want. You can bring together sci-fi, noir, literary fiction, science fiction, fantasy, magic realism, whatever you want to do. And that really helped me sort of figure out what I wanted to do. So when it came to finally getting this book out, Zero Saints, I was probably on the last chapter, and I was thinking, it's too weird for the crime folks. It's too noir for the horror people. It's too horror for the bizarro crowd. It's too bizarro for everybody else. I don't know what this is. And then I thought, this is what I've always wanted to write. It's bilingual. It's barrio noir. I'm just going to take that term and run with it. And it worked out.
What kind of a setting are you looking to create in this genre of yours?
At some point I read a brilliant definition of noir, that basically said noir is kind of just really awful things happening to good people. And I had also heard that noir was just about people on a bad path that they know is a bad path, but they can't get out of. So with those things in mind, there's a lot about identity, syncretism, language, crime. Basically all of my bad guys are not really that bad. They're just humans who made a couple of bad decisions. So every time that I go for a setting, it's probably in the south of the U.S. It's California, it's Texas, it's Florida. And I'm always dealing with multiculturalism. So that's my setting is always going to be probably very flawed people doing or having very bad things happen to them on or near the border or on both sides of the border during the entire novel.
So why don't you give a little nutshell about what Zero Saints is about?
Zero Saints started as me trying to write something new for an invitation that I'd received to go read at Noir at the Bar, Oklahoma. And I just had this, I had a few crime stories in my head, and they sort of coagulated into an entire narrative. So I wrote that first chapter. I read it in Oklahoma for the first time ever. The rest is history, but I wanted to tell the story of someone in Austin, just like me, I've been in the city for 9 years now, who also, like me, kind of had to deal with being place. And in this case, I just went with an undocumented person, in this case, Fernando, because I thought if my life is hard having an American passport, if I didn't have that, I wouldn't have X and Y opportunities, and I wouldn't have so many doors open to me. So if my life is hard and I'm poor and I have to hustle to pay my bills, I can only imagine what someone without that blue passport would have to go through. And from there, I just rolled with all the elements that I enjoy, violence, weirdness, religion, saints, devils, guns, a little bit of love thrown in, and a lot of vengeance and a lot of weirdness, because I like weird stuff.
Saints, devils, guns, and vengeance. Really, does it get any better than that?
I think so too. Glad you agree.
And I've read, because I was looking through I was looking through some of the reviews on it, and more than one reviewer commented on the way you wove Santeria into the story. And I agreed on that. It was very, very fascinating. Where did that come from?
So basically, growing up, my dad was sort of an atheist. My mom was a devout Christian. My grandma on my mom's side was sort of a santera. Her house was full of saints and candles and that kind of really hardcore Caribbean mixed syncretism devotion. And then outside of the household door, most of the people that I knew practiced some sort of religion that is not, let me call it, straightforward or clearly defined. So by the time I was in high school, I knew santeros, I knew people who practiced santeria, people who practiced voodoo, people who went to Palo Mayombe, Mesa Blanca. So it was just that powerful mixture of influences that basically makes up the entire culture as a whole, of the pan-Caribbean culture. So growing up in that, it never had an impact on me on how magical and how weird and how fantastic it was until I moved here, and then those elements sort of grew inside my head as, oh my God, I was involved in all of these things and I saw all of this stuff happen, and now that I've removed from it, it sort of takes on a different phase, and I kind of wanted to write about it, and it became a large part of what I want to do with Barrio Noir, and a large part of Barrio Noir is. So I'm going to keep rolling with the weirdness, because God knows that God and the devil know that as soon as you start mentioning religion to people, it's always kind of iffy. But once you go outside of the parameters of regular fiction, and then you bring in all that other weirdness that I've been witnessing for 30 years, it sort of becomes a little bit more interesting.
Well, and those type of religions, Santeria, Voodoo, and the Caribbean religions, they're so visceral and they're so guttural and base as in right down to the ground and down to the soul. So did you find that also helped make that background that much richer, your backdrop?
Yeah, I mean, I've met very devout Christians and Catholics, but they never compared to the amount of fervent devotion felt by people who suddenly needed something, and to get that something, they knew they were going to have to go out and do a ritual, and that it'll probably involve blood. So it's religions that I think are closer to the earth, and
yes,
most of them have a past that is it's very noir. It's people hiding from others, people putting their gods inside the images that the oppressor was giving them.
Yes.
So they're playful, but they're also, you can feel the resentment, you can feel the history in them when you study them. You can feel that element of magic. And for them, for most of these religions, what other people consider miracles is just you did a job, un trabajo, and it worked. And that's how their religions work. There's basically no miracles. You choose your deity that kind of covers that area, and then you do what you have to do, and then something happens. It's just like this automatic response, and then you move on with your life, and then the next time that you need something, you slaughter another animal, or you prepare another another job, or you go talk to another person who knows a little bit more about what's going on and who needs to be addressed in that situation, and you do it, and you keep on living.
And that's actually very, very interesting, because I hadn't thought about it that way. But my best friend worked at Botanica for many years, and the boss of the Botanica was a Santero, and she assisted with a lot of the rituals. And it's always working with the Orishas, not worshiping, not begging, not pleading. It's always working with
right.
the Orishas. And that was very, very, very interesting. And it's one of the parts of Zero Saints that was very intriguing to me. One question, though, I was, again, looking through the reviews, and what your tiny handful of one-star reviews all had a problem with. And you know what I'm about to say, don't you?
Yeah, a little bit of the language thing.
The Spanglish and how it's written.
Yeah.
Why don't you describe how it was written and what your thought process was there?
Thought process was kind of short, and I'm lucky because I found J. David Osborne and Broken River Books. But at that point, and I've always been an indie author my entire life for the three books and I don't know how many anthologies. It's all indie. So for this story, I knew that the way that I wanted to tell it, in order for it to be real, to feel authentic, it, for example, Fernando had to talk the way that we talk. We Spanglish speakers talk that way to each other because you're talking in your native tongue, which for us is Spanish, and then you don't remember a word. And then after you've been in the U.S. for a while, movies and music and the books that you consume and the people you talk to and the work that you do, You pick up all these words that you, because you're using English with everybody else, you don't always bother to find the translation. So you end up having one gigantic language, and then which is Spanglish, and then you have Spanish, which is your native tongue, and usually you know perfectly well. And then English, that if you have to use only English, that's when you start having conversations where you stop, you have to think about the word. You think about what you want to say, and then you translate it. You do all that code switching in your head. So for this story, I knew if it was going to be authentic and I wanted it to feel real and authentic, it had to be in Spanglish. We don't translate prayers. So I just rolled with it. J. David loved it, and Zero Saints came out. The first few comments hate emails and one-star reviews kind of made me take a step back and go like, oh my God, maybe. And then it almost immediately was like, well, you know what? It's a barrio noir. It's about a guy from Mexico named Fernando and a guy named Gavin Iglesias wrote it. Maybe you should have read the synopsis. If you didn't think there was going to be some Spanish in there, you're kind of wrong to begin with. And second of all, if that's the kind of book that pisses you off because it has some Spanish on it, sorry, didn't write it for you. So thanks for the purchase, though. I love those. I wish I had 10,000 verified purchase one-star reviews.
Okay, now that's funny. And I'll say with my very, very basic Spanish, plus when I was in high school, I was forced to take like a semester and a half of basic Latin. And I've discovered that since I was forced to take Latin in school, when I've been either in Mexico or when I was in France, I can't speak the language all that well, but I can read it pretty well. And when you just did that between rolling with that and context, it didn't slow it down at all. There were places where I had to chew a little bit more thoroughly. But it didn't. It did not slow down the gist of the story at all. So, and you know, and I learned a lot. And it was again. It was. It also just added to that dark, dark mood you portrayed through the entire story.
Right. So this is probably the only part where I have to try to sound like a real author. I just let me change my voice real quick.
Yes.
I spent some time rereading my work and trying to make sure that even though I didn't want to give you English because it needed to be authentic and it needed to be written in Spanglish, I made sure that within context you could at least get the gist of where I was going. And I don't want to toot the horn of all my smart friends, but because you can't always trust your friends because they love you and they say nice things. But friendly acquaintances have said, I don't speak a lot of Spanish, but I kind of got what was happening. It never really distracted me too much from the action. And another thing that I always mention, I was talking about this in a panel at ArmadilloCon, which was this weekend. No one bitched and moaned about the Russian and the Yoruba languages in that book. It was only the Spanish. So that kind of tells me something about who you are, where you can read Yoruba, not understand it, because I know this. If people don't speak a lot of Spanish, I'm kind of hard to – I mean, I don't think they speak Yoruba or Russian. Maybe they do. I don't know. I'm going to guess not. So if those other two languages didn't bother you, but the Spanish did, then I think your problem goes a little bit deeper than just my book.
And I agree with you. And you can add me to that list of people who were able to. And there were, I mean, there were places where I wasn't reading it in the traditional sense, as in every word I was decoding it. And there's nothing wrong with that. For example, the last time I was in Paris, I wandered into this little church right into the middle of a classic traditional mass that was being done in French and Latin. I can't tell you I understood a single word they said, but I darn well understood what they were doing. I understood the context. They were praying. And that's what was important. It was the mood, man. Talk about some noir. Stumble into a small church in the Latin Quarter in Paris during a mass. I mean, that was a very, very interesting experience that may show up in a book sometime. So you're saying too, yeah, the church was amazing. It still had parts of its windows boarded up from World War II. And I mean, this was in the Latin Quarter in Paris. It was just really amazing. But you've been saying, too, that you're giving yourself a self-imposed writer's retreat. So what are you working on?
I never learned to follow the advice of the pros, so I'm usually working on more than one thing at once. What I'm trying to focus on right now is on getting the next Broken River book out. It's been a while. I'm a slow writer, sadly. But I don't try to just put words down if I don't feel comfortable or I don't know where the story's going. I've had a few breakdowns, so I call JDO, and I say I'm gonna suck at this, and I don't know how I managed it the last time. And then he gives me a little bit of therapy, or I just sit down at home and then I remind myself, wait, I've done this before. I've done this a couple of times. I've written like 5 books. I can do this again. And then I have that little extra fire because I need it to be. It cannot be a rehash of Zero Saints, but I do want to take Barrio Noir forward, so I have to do that now. I feel like I owe it to myself. And then for everyone that sort of had a problem with – I just had a lady this weekend come up to my table while I was signing. She picked up the book. She started reading the first chapter, and then she looked at me. And then she kept reading, and her eyebrows kind of knotted together, and then she looked at me again. And then finally she closed the book, placed it down on the table, and said, "Wow, young man, I will not be buying this. It is way too violent for me. But that's a great cover."
Yes.
So I can promise you this. I know I've made people wait for the next one like I'm some kind of diva. I'm not. I'm trying to get it out. But it'll be in Spanglish. It'll be a Barrio Noir. That'll be weirdness and a lot of blood and a lot of suffering. And with Zero Saints, I kind of wanted to get that part of the immigration thing out of my system. With this one, I'm going to dabble into that, but I kind of presented myself with this challenge that is kind of, how can I make people hurt? I want people to read the book and not identify with a character like Fernando. I have other characters. I have kids in the book. I want them to hurt. If I can manage to hurt one person, then I'll consider the next book a success. And even the process, well, I make a lot of other people angry at the Spanglish. Come see these hands.
Well, Zero Saints definitely has some just gutting moments in it. And for me, they may not be the ones that you were expected. For me, like when, again, it's been a while since I read it, so forgive me if I get the context wrong, but it's when he goes to visit and the Santera auntie does the ritual spell for him.
Right.
I found that to just be, wow. I mean, that one was just, that was like, you know, digging nails into my arm, and it was fantastic.
Thank you.
You know, much more so, I find that much more so than just like the, you know, in-your-face violence. I mean, I write in-your-face violence. You know, my main character carries a specialized shotgun for a reason. But it's those moments when the darkness just seeps in around the edges that it's like, oh, that hurt. So
right.
The new book you're writing on, is it going to be in the same storyline as Zero Saints, or just the same genre?
Just the same genre. Both of them are going to be barrio noirs. They're entirely separate. But if people want to start calling barrio noir a universe or borderline, any story that takes place in the border, sort of like the border as in Gloria Anzaldúa's borderlands, then yes, it's all in the same universe. And I had to give a cameo to the visionary, to Isaac. I kind of mentioned him in one of those two books because he was a character that I loved from the get-go, and I thought it'd be kind of cool. You always want of new people to read your books, but you also want people who read the previous one to enjoy it enough to buy your next one. So I thought it'd be kind of nice to have a little pseudo secret cameo in there from a character from Zero Saints. So yeah.
I mean, it's way too, you know, I guess it'd be like, you know, a dragon Easter egg or something like that, since no traditional Easter egg would show up in Barrio Noir.
Right. right.
One of your reviewers used the phrase "set on la frontera." Is that a good description of your world?
At the beginning, I kind of went with it without really thinking about it. And then I realized after the book was out, I realized there's a chapter about crossing la frontera that a lot of people seem to like. Some of my favorite authors have said this chapter was really good. And then I realized not only am I dealing with the Mexican U.S. border, I'm also dealing with the border between, as a person, when you do good things and bad things and where you draw the line. And also with the whole spiritual Santeria religion thing, there's another border, because not everybody believes, you know, in all of my stories. So yeah, it's frontera fiction.
Well, then get yourself into that writing retreat, because now I'm looking forward to the second book, and you'd better come back when you do the second book as well. So other things that are going on.
I will call you up as soon as it comes out.
Congratulations on your PhD.
Thank you.
What is it in? What did you study? Tell me a little bit about that part of yourself, what your education is.
So every time I look at my bank account, I realize I'm the guy who quit law school after 2 years to pursue journalism. So eventually I moved to the U.S. and got a PhD in journalism.
Okay. That's fascinating. And are we going to have to like start calling you doctor now when we run into you at conferences? We won't be able to get your attention otherwise.
I remember sitting down in a classroom at the University of Texas at Austin and having this young lady raise her hand and go, "Excuse me, professor, And the lady who was teaching the class turned around and she said, "It's a doctor." And at that moment, I despised any human being who answers like that. So no, no, not at all.
Well, when I graduated law school, there was the big debate over whether or not we were going to start putting Esquire after our names.
Right, and that sounds even more regal.
And I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't. As a matter of fact, I laughed every time someone suggested it. And over the years, because I practiced for about, I don't know, 15 years or so before I just said, "What am I doing?" And every once in a while, I'd get something addressed to, you know, Terry Lynn Coop, Esquire, and it'd be like,
Esquire.
I'd be looking around. Yeah, I'd be like looking around wondering who it was for. So I agree with you. I mean, you earned those letters and we're proud of you for them. But yeah, the pretense and the ceremony, oh, please.
I tell people I'm honest. All I really wanted was a chance to find a gig in academia so I could have my summers and my Christmases off. That was the motivation behind it. So, yeah, still looking for that teaching gig. So in the meantime, I don't even talk about the whole PhD thing. I got it over with. It took me almost of actual work. It was probably 7 years because I missed a year because I busted my eye. Horror story. I scratched my cornea so bad that I could basically not see out of that eye for a while.
Yeah.
But yeah, about 7 years, got it done. It's out of my life right now. But when someone says anything about a job interview, I can just say, comma, PhD, and try to get that.
Well, and as I remember too, there was, and again, a legitimate pride of accomplishment because, like me, there are people when I became an engineer. You know, first thing people were asking me was, well, but when are you going to get married? You know, things like that. So there's real accomplishment in being able to reach these benchmarks and go, you know, screw you.
I'm done. Yeah. Screw you.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons I think I went to engineering school is because so many people told me I couldn't be an astronaut. So I became an engineer instead. And I think there in my class, my civil engineering class, I think there were three women.
There you go.
Exactly. I mean, there's definitely more now. It's one of those. I became a civil engineer, so that was one of those frontier. Jobs that had to be broken down by women, and I'm very proud to have been in that wave because it's no big deal now, but it was a big deal then. So
yeah,
mainly
you had to hack away at that wall. Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, you couldn't, even when I went to work for Mobil Oil, I think there were 20 of us, and there's like me and the other woman in the hiring class at the opposite ends of the photo. You know, that sort of thing. And these days that's not the case. So it's awesome. And when I went to law school, you know, it's like I think it's 55 to 60% women now, most legal graduating classes. So we're taking over. Absolutely.
It's about time too. You're smarter. So good thing.
Now, these days you write a fair amount of nonfiction. What don't we see? We see a lot of the columns and blogs. Do you write for Lit Reactor? Am I correct there?
Yes, you are.
Okay. I love your columns when they pop up.
Thank you. Yeah, like I said, it's I get a lot of critiques and hate mail from those columns. At this point, I don't care. I had a political column for about 6 years back home. In Puerto Rico's largest newspaper, so circulation when I started, it was about 2 million on the island, so people saw it, people wrote to me, people found my email and told me, if I ever see you on the streets, I'm going to kill you. Never happened, and now that I tend to write nonfiction that's sort of it has this literary angle. I'm talking usually about authors or the writing process or books, and people just take themselves so damn seriously. So I just laugh. I laugh all the way to the computer and write another one. But it's kind of strange because I started journalism. I was paying my bills doing freelance work for many years. Then I worked full-time for the Austin Post as a journalist. And then I kind of moved into other jobs while trying to finish the PhD. And now it kind of came full circle where I'm pitching stories, pitching columns and getting them accepted. So it's finally kind of okay. So now I've reached the only good thing about having a platform, really, because it doesn't necessarily translate into book sales. But the good thing is that you can say, hey, I've had X amount of columns. Go check them out. People interact with them. People share them. People enjoy them. So here's a bunch of wild ideas that I kind of want to explore. And then I have folks like the Lit Reactor family who go, every month they tell me, like, okay, here's what you're going to do this month. And I just have a blast with it. Christoph Paul and Les Agantoral over at Clash Media also publish my columns. They basically let me do whatever the hell I want. I was talking on Twitter about the stuff I said on Twitter. If you're angry, the people who are angry at my columns should see the stuff I don't even dare pitch. And a few authors jumped on there and said, like, well, give us an example. And I said, well, I once thought about this column about 10 types of authors who should go fuck themselves. And they said, oh, my God, that's brilliant. I want to read that. So I wrote that, and it kind of went viral. And then Lessa and Christoph published it on Clash because they're gutsy folks, and then they don't care. So, yeah, I've been lucky. I found great editors, great venues. They more or less let me get away with just messing with people and being humorous and having fun.
Well, and it's thoughtful, and I loved your column, too, about your last random road trip to New Mexico, correct?
Yes.
That was fantastic.
I was on the road, and it was just the road and music and my head, and I just kept seeing town after town, and suddenly my brain started playing with those names, and I sat down at the hotel. I came into the hotel room, popped the computer open, and everything was so fresh that I wrote that and forgot about it until I drove back to Austin. And then the same story. It's a weird thing about driving from Austin to Santa Fe. Where the heck am I going to send this? And then Tobias Carroll at Volume 1 Brooklyn, I said, I have this thing. Would you mind taking a look? And he took a look and said, I'm publishing this thing. So I don't know. I'm very lucky. A lot of people complain about how hard it is to be to get things out there. And it is, because you get I love getting rejections because it sort of keeps you humble and makes you remember not always you're not going to hear yes all the time. But I've been lucky with nonfiction because most of the people that I pitch stuff to say, yes, let's do it, and it gets out there. And people seem to like it, so I'm going to do a lot more.
Well, and you have done you have put in the hard work, and you've gotten the traction that you needed, that they know that whatever you're going to turn out is not going to be vanilla. It's going to have really sharp edges on it. And it's going to be interesting and get reactions. There's nothing in the world wrong with that. But you're also talking.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. Yeah.
But you're also talking
funny.
To
you
someone
who's
going to
become a millionaire. So.
Yeah. But you're also talking to someone who once drove to Tucumcari because I wanted a Spanish omelet.
There you go.
And I happen to know a place. So. I was in law school, and it was Thursday night, and I said I had the next day off, and it's like, do you know what I really, really want? It was Santa Rosa, excuse me, not Tucumcari. I said, you know what I really, really want? I want a Spanish omelet at the Silver Moon Cafe. And I was there in time for breakfast, and I told the nice lady who brought me my breakfast what I'd done, and she looked at me and was like, oh, that's nice.
I mean, it was worth the trip.
Well, and bless her heart, she had no freaking clue. She thought I was crazy, but it's like it was a really good Spanish omelet. And then I kept going from there until a few days later I woke up in Sholo, Arizona, and went, my God, what am I doing here? I need to go home. So I can completely appreciate, you know, the value of a random road trip. And if for some reason you ever get a wild hare to come through Kansas, let me know. You've got a couch you can stay on anytime.
Will do.
Hey, it's cool here. We have cool stuff here.
I've never been. Yeah, Kansas City sounds great. It's popped up in a lot of stories, so, and I've never been.
Kansas City has its cool points, both the sunny side and the less sunny side, for sure. And I see too, you write a lot. You like to write a lot of short fiction too, correct? In the Flash, the 1,000 to 1,500 word range.
It's one of those things where you get an idea and you go like, oh, I kind of dig this idea, and then you sit with it and you take a shower with it and you eat with that thing in your head, and then you realize this is not a novel, it's not a novella, it's just a cute little idea. I'm going to get it out of my system in 1,500 words, 3,000 words, 900 words, and send it off. Because not a lot of people will say, I have all these ideas. You do, but not every idea needs to be a novel. So I'm trying to train myself to recognize what things I want to spend a year and a half working on, and which ones I can just try to sit down in 2-3 days, bang it out, let it rest, come back, edit it, and send it out.
Well, I see. I also consider my inclusion in Out of the Gutter to be a real pride, because I think it's a great site that really turns out some good work. So when I finally got my acceptance from them, I was like, ah, hell yeah.
I think it's like a school. I picked up this new novel or this new short story collection. This name kind of sounds familiar, and then you go back, and it's because Flash Fiction Offensive had one or two or three pieces by that author. So it's a nice little place, and they're good people.
Definitely, definitely. And you are, when you get into that site, you get accepted at that site, you're in some damn good company. That is for sure. So
yes,
I consider them and places like Shotgun Honey and other of those to be, that's legit right there. Accepted there.
I'm working on something for Shotgun Honey now, because it's like one of my white whales. I've always been scared to submit, so now I finally have something that I think might be the thing that I send them. So
get on that. Because I'll be interested to see what you can do in 700 words. And
I'll
hate
let
it.
You know.
We're actually time is passing. So I asked you earlier if you could prepare a short reading. Do you have one?
Sure.
Because I want to hear it pronounced. I want to hear it correct.
Let's see.
So you can roll whenever you're ready.
Let's do a chunk of this Frontera chapter. And
excellent,
yeah.
Excellent.
I'll dedicate this one to the great Ben Whitmer, who loves this chapter. And every time I'm down, he has some word of encouragement for me. So this one goes out to him.
I'll drink to that. Roll with it.
All right. What happens when you cross La Frontera is that you leave a place to enter a void. You vacate a known reality and change it for something that you have to force yourself to believe, to accept, to understand. What happens when you cross la frontera is that you share un pedazo grande of your identity and become a different thing, something that's part apparition, part useless flesh, and part broken memories. You abandon familia, amigos, lenguaje, and the streets you know for a place where you have no rights and are not even considered a citizen. A country in which you will live like a stowaway brat, always afraid of being discovered. So you change. You morph. Te vuelves otra cosa. You start speaking English fast in hopes that your brown skin will be ignored if you at least communicate well. You dress yourself with the comics you read and the books you hated in school and the movies you watched since you were a kid, and that thing becomes el nuevo tú. You cover your tatuajes and learn that people on the street will remember you only if you speak Spanish in their presence. You do everything in your power to become a gringo, to fit in, to become as unnoticeable as the cracks in the sidewalks. Then you start walking with less confidence because everything is mysterious and new and scary, and you never feel bienvenido. What happens when you cross la frontera is that la frontera keeps a piece of you, cuts you inside hasta el hueso, where you can't heal yourself. It slashes you in places no blade or bullet can reach and cripples you in ways you don't understand. Cruzar la frontera fucks you over in formas que no sabías que podía ser jodido. What happens when you cross la frontera is that your body becomes a magnet for the bad stuff that has piled up along that awful dividing line. Muerte, destrucción, desesperación, olvido, la nada infinita, la noche eterna full of screams. Crossing la frontera is like crossing a swamp because you end up covered in unpleasant shit no matter what you do. La frontera is a place of crying espíritus. It's a place of almas perdidas y en pena, all of them looking for a way back, for a way to undo what happened, for a path back to their loved ones and their known places and a time before they made their awful decision. And I'm going to leave it there.
That was freaking awesome. Sorry, you're going to have to come back and just like read, you know, because that was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And
for
basically,
having me.
I have to do a couple of little housekeeping announcements I have to make here. And I want to say, too, that I want to thank everyone who's made this month for me starting the show to be just incredible. On Wednesday night, we have thriller writer John Gilstrap. And on Friday, get out my little calendar here. Oh, we have the one and only Mike Cole, who is going to be talking about military science fiction. J.D. Rhodes, Chuck Wendig, Angel Colon, Eric Beatner, Chris Holm. This is going to be a fantastic one. And this, I owe it all to my sponsor, Down and Out Books, that is celebrating 6 years of award-winning crime fiction. You can check them out at www.downandoutbooks.com. And this podcast is owned and copyrighted by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. You can follow us on Facebook to keep up with the latest broadcasts. Thank you much, sir, and we shall be talking again.
Thank you much, ma'am, and it'll be my pleasure.
And a little bit of music, and I will say goodnight.